Welcome to the Guitar Channel. I am super happy to welcome you a new interview. I have on the other side of the Zoom connection the one and only Yannick Guizdala. Hopefully, I did not destroy completely your last name. Yannick, how are you doing today?
Very well. Happy to be a bass imposter on your guitar channel.
It's always a pleasure to do an interview with bass player, you know, and as I always say that it's sometimes the bass player is a more discreet species than the guitar player, you know, so it's kind of difficult for me to grab some bass player to do interviews, but it's always a pleasure. And as much as possible, I try to get them to come here to my showroom in Paris, but at least let's do this first in Zoom. So where are you based, by the way, Yannick?
I'm in Los Angeles, California.
Okay, so you are 9, yeah. So it's 10 a.m. for you at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So tell me, Yannick, what was your very first instrument? Did you start on bass right from the start, or did you start with the guitar or piano or anything else?
I started with just about everything else before I got to bass. Like, you know, classical guitar came first, which was very useful for bass. I studied classical guitar really intensely for many years from the age of about 10 or 11. But also drums and French horn was actually the very, very, very first instrument, French horn, when I was maybe, I don't know, nine years old. It didn't last very long, thankfully, for the world of French horn. They're all very grateful. But, you know, trumpet and guitar and piano and drums, and eventually I found the bass.
Mm-hmm. And what was the inspiration to pick up the bass? Did you lose a bet and you were the only guy available? Because sometimes it starts like that. So what's your story?
No, but I'm going to start telling people that because that's a good story. No, I really wanted to be a drummer. Like, even though I was like the instrument I was taking most seriously was classical guitar. And I was, you know, studying the Bach lute suites and Benjamin Britten and, you know, the Rodriguez concerto, all these like pretty heavy classical pieces. But I really loved commercial music and jazz in particular, the influence of my father, having, you know, listened to that his whole life and attempted to play that on piano. Attempted.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but no, a friend of mine said, come to this gig, you know, you're going to love the bass player. And I was like, bass player? What do I care? You know, who gives a shit? And I said, who's the drummer? Drummer was great. So I was like, okay, I go to the gig. And boom, that was it. Sunday, 12 o'clock in a pub in London. And on Monday morning, I'm going and taking the few pennies I have in the bank and buying in my first bass, literally a day later. And most, I can't believe it's sitting here on the desk, but we recorded that gig.
Wow. Cool.
And not on a micro cassette, actually, on a bigger dictaphone, but I have somewhere the cassette tape of that exact gig and that bass player who became my mentor for 2.5, almost 3 years before I moved to America.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of taught me everything I know.
So you had to start with quite a good background in music before you pick up the bass, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
In classical music.
Okay.
I would say, you know, with an interest, I was listening to the radio. So Michael Jackson and Madonna and Elton John, whatever was on the radio at the time, you know, but yes, specifically classical music, which was great for reading and general comprehension, how to practice, you know, discipline, focus, you know, that stuff is not easy. It's not like some jazz or blues lick, which is also not easy to get right and to be convincing and to be honest and to be original. But the classical side of things really showed me how to be disciplined as a young musician.
Mm-hmm. I know you have a bass right around where you are. So can you pick up the bass and play me the very first bass line you were able to play? And you know, the bass line you played over and over because you were so happy to be able to play it.
Wow. Talk about being on the spot. probably. Boom, 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 da, 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 da.
Yes, Owner of a Lonely Heart,
right?
Excellent.
Owner of a Lonely Heart, dum bum, dum. You know, the whole bit. I was a big kind of Yes fan. Like my dad, you know, I was born in the 70s. I grew up listening to music in the 80s, and what my dad was listening to was that. My mom was listening to like more the folk side of things, you know, the Joni Mitchell, the Joan Baez, the Bob Dylan. My dad was listening to more like Return to Forever and Weather Report, Miles Davis. Yes. Like, so I kind of had those two worlds colliding with me in the middle.
And who would you say are your main influences regarding bass?
Stravinsky. I mean, like, I found like just anyone except bass player.
Okay.
I would say I found out very, very early that there was quite a it sounds really bad, and I don't mean to put down bass players, but the harmonic and melodic range of what you traditionally hear from a bass player is, by nature of the instrument, not that great. And what I was interested in initially was more the melodic side and harmonic side, the chordal side of things. So I checked out basically everyone but bass players, and then came to James Jamerson and Carole Kay and all the classic people you would know. But the biggest person for me was Michele Ndegicello. When I really found groove and when I found pocket and playing a jazz bass with, you know, with that kind of mid-rangey Jaco sound, but in a groove sense, it was Michele. And I wore those records out, the early records, Peace Beyond Passion and Plantation Lullabies. I must have played thousands, if not tens of thousands of times along with those records. That's what gave me my groove, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, what's your connection with Marc Lethierry? Because Marc is the guy who put me in touch with you. So what's your link with Marc?
So, I mean, aside from being aware of him as a musician in the scene and a fan of his playing and all of that, we got to work together. I was about to say recently, but now it's been a while because the pandemic, this 1 year, kind of shunted our memory a little bit, I think. But because of his work with Snarky Puppy and one of my best friends in the world, someone I've been working with since the 90s, Bob Reynolds, tenor saxophone player, and Bob is in Snarky Puppy also with Mark. So through that association, Mark came to Los Angeles. He ended up sitting in on a gig we were doing here in town, and then he ended up being on Bob Reynolds' new record, which I was writing and producing and playing bass on. So that all happened in, I think me and Mark played together the first time kind of in late 2019. And then we went in the studio to make that record in January of 2020.
Mm-hmm. Okay, excellent. So Mark, if you ever you're watching this, thank you very much for putting me in touch with Yannick. That's awesome.
Yeah.
tell me, so you have we're going to talk about your music and everything, but to prepare this interview, I went through your YouTube channel, which is pretty big because you have, I think, around more than 60K followers, so which is huge. So how do you organize the work you do as a working musician and what you do as a content creator? Because you obviously produce a lot of super high quality video, give reviews, interviews and stuff like that. So how do you balance everything?
I think sometimes very well and sometimes very poorly. and it really, everything depends, you know. The big word for me pretty much with everything is necessity. And it has become more necessity the older I get and the more technology and the music industry changes to be a content creator.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not particularly happy about it a lot of the time, I got to say, because it's a lot of work. As I'm sure you know, you got to set your recording levels and this and the camera and the lights and the script and the content. And it used to be really nice when I was just a bass player and the phone would ring and it would be Mike Stern and say, "Hey man, you want to go to China?" You know, and we'd go on tour and I'd receive money for that and I would play the bass and then I would go home and that would be it. You know, I'd get back to making music. So in that sense, it's a big shift, but it's also out of necessity and kind of not ignoring the current climate that we live in. And then of course the last year everything is like accelerated in the online space because that's literally the only thing that was available. But in the balance is just what screams the loudest gets the most attention. And throughout that I have to also maintain the fact that I am still a bass player and this is my number one goal. So I have to sometimes force myself not to do the content creation side. You know, because it can overtake pretty easily.
And is it bringing you some work as a musician to have this big YouTube presence, or is it basically eating a lot of time and not bringing a lot of business for you?
No, it's a little bit of both. It does eat a lot of time, especially now that I've kind of upped the production level and I'm shooting everything in 4K and I'm doing edits and soundtracks and, you know, cutaways and B-roll footage and slow-mo and all this bullshit. So it does eat some time. But at the same time, I'm about to publish my, I think, 19th or 20th book. So in terms of a platform to let people know about the educational content I'm creating, it's kind of priceless. It's a free marketing platform, although I try not to use it as that. I don't just make ads for YouTube for myself. I try and create content that people actually they're going to dig. You know, that's how the algorithm works. Yeah. You know, compared to some people, I'm really shit at working the algorithm. There are some things I just won't do. Like, I won't use clickbait. I won't be dishonest about the content. I'm not going to talk about, oh my god, like this person just make all these crazy claims, which is total bullshit. So there's a limit to what I'll do, but for my little world, it's so far it's worked. It worked great.
Yeah, and I think we all know these kind of tactics, and obviously they work, but it's also a way to project your personality. So I totally see where you're going with that. And again, I have to congratulate you for the quality of the video you are producing, because I watched a couple of them, and there was one especially watched regarding transcription, which is really interesting. And all the content you were actually pushing were very to the point. And even though I am definitely not a bass player, and I am lousy, and I'm not able to read, I know probably how to put a note in a music sheet, and that's about it. Yep. So, but still, your content was very, very interesting. So, congratulations for that. And I'm sure it's also a way to marketing what you do, but in a good way. And congratulations for doing all this work. So, and I think, yes, basically, all the modern, let's say, musicians are doing this at the moment. So that's the way to go.
Mm. Also, but that brings up a very good point. It can be the way to go, but it's also a huge goal of mine to get really far away from it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, having gone so far into it, the system has changed so much. YouTube used to be based on merit. You used to be able to make good content, and people could choose to see the content they wanted. Now they have no choice. Now people are forced to see the content that works for the algorithm. Mm-hmm. So it's no longer a platform that works for artists. It's no longer a platform that makes sense to create the kind of content I and a lot of other people create, unless you're willing to sell out and go through the bullshit lens of clickbait and basically lying to your audience. Mm-hmm. You know, so
but
that's,
still, people are able to search through videos. I don't know if they look for, I didn't do the test, but if they search for bass transcription, they might end up finding your video, right?
They might. But the overwhelming experience is when you open an application in your cell phone that you are going to be pushed content first.
Yeah.
Before you even start to search, you have suggestions of things to watch.
Yeah.
Mm. You know what I mean? So the goal is to kind of get away from that and get into a new space of creation, which is coming. Mm-hmm. I think YouTube is going to be pretty obsolete quite soon.
Okay.
And I think the blockchain technology, I think that the NFT space is going to overtake this and be really, really valuable for content creators and give far more long-term value for everyone, mm-hmm. for the user and for the creator. Mm-hmm.
You just mentioned Mike Stern, so I had the pleasure to do an interview with him at the Montreal Jazz Festival a couple of years ago, and it was, for me, it was like meeting Yoda, you know, but playing the guitar. So he's so wise, super cool, and everything. So tell me your story. How did you get that phone call? Where's Mike Stern calling you like
hey!
That? So,
So this goes back a long time. So when I was still living in London, I was working for an American producer that has since moved back here, but lived in London for 35 years, a guy called Richard Niles, arranger and producer, worked with all of these cats, Ray Charles, Pet Shop Boys, the huge gigs. And I got to work with him through a piano player friend. And I told him I was going to go to Berkeley. And I told him I was a huge Mike Stern fan. And he had been in Boston, in Berkeley, in 1973. And written a guitar quartet for Mike Stern, Pat Metheny, Mitch Kudlow, and Jay Azzolina. And so he knew all of these guys since the early 70s. And he said, well, let's just make a tape. This was back in the days where you could like record a demo and send it. So it was a CD. But he said, let's send Mike a CD. Let's write some music. You can record it at my studio and let's send Mike a CD and see what he thinks. I've got his address here. I'll call him and tell him it's coming. So this is before I went to Berkeley. So we send it. Richard wrote me some beautiful music. We send the CD to Mike. It's like 3 months before I'm going to Berkeley. I don't hear anything. I get to Boston and my phone rings in my mom's house, in my house. Hey, is Yannick there? Hey. This is like, and I'm gone already. I'm living in Boston. I'm going to Berkeley. And my mom's like, no, who's this? Hey, this is Mike Stern. And my mom's like, because she's listened to me transcribing Mike Stern. Yeah, exactly. Because she's been listening to me for 3 years transcribing all Mike's solos and learning his tunes. So she knows what's up. And he said, like, man, I got this tape. I really like the music. You know, where's Yannick at? And she gave him my number in Boston. He called me. This is 1998.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm in Boston. He's in New York. He came to Berkeley in early 99. Early 99 to do a clinic and a concert. And I met him then for the first time in person, although we'd been talking on the phone. But it wasn't till about 2004 that we actually started playing together. Once I quit Berkeley and moved to New York, I got kind of busy on the road and doing like pop touring and stuff like that. And when I was kind of starting to reach my limit with playing as a sideman in pop groups, we managed to reconnect and he called and that was it. I started going over to his apartment and playing for hours and hours every day, you know, playing All the Things You Are or Autumn Leaves for 3 hours without stopping.
Mm.
And this was kind of the audition process for a couple of weeks. And he would like randomly say, hey, do you know this tune of mine? And I'd be like, yep. Which key do you want to play it in? You know, like I was born for this gig, basically. And then, of course, I don't know if you know about the 55 Bar in New York.
Nope.
Okay, so it's a tiny club, holds 78 people. Are you in Paris, by the way?
Yes.
Okay, so it's like Le Bazir Salé or Sunset or something. Really small jazz club, you know? And he plays there Monday and Wednesday every week that he's in town.
Okay, interesting.
For 30 years. Okay, for a really long time. So that's like the local gig. That's where we work on music. That's like the rehearsal, but it's actually a gig. So I did a few of those. And within a couple of months, we were making trips, you know, going Miami and Chicago and then Brazil, like all kinds of places. And that was like 2003, 2004. So it's been a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's been almost 20 years. Well, it's been 23 years of knowing him and over almost 20 years of playing with him.
And what did you take from playing with such a giant of a musician?
A couple of really big things. Number one, that I had made the right choice.
Meaning?
To be a musician.
Ah, okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, all the work I'd put in, even in the early 2000s, it still wasn't like 20 years of work I'd put in. It was maybe 7 or 8, but still it was like intense 9, 10, 11, 12 hours a day that started to really pay off in something meaningful to me, something I had had a goal of doing and then was fulfilling that goal. There's a concert from 1992, Brecker Brothers live in Barcelona, from the Return of the Brecker Brothers tour. And it's Dennis Chambers, James Genus, Mike Stern, Michael and Randy Brecker, and George Withy. And I wore that VHS out. And my goal, long before Berkeley, long before anything, like in the first few months of playing the bass, my goal was to play with everyone in that band. And so far, mission accomplished. You know, Mike was the first guy. You know, Mike was... Yeah, so it was just fulfilling goals. And then the time. There are only two important things in music to me, is time and sound as a musician. These are the two most important things. They're the things that identify when you hear John Coltrane. You hear the sound and you hear one note to the next and this is the time and you know it's John Coltrane. You know when you listen to Mike Stern that it's not John Scofield and it's not Bill Frisell and it's not Wayne Krantz and it's not B.B. King and it's not Stevie Ray Vaughan. And when you hear Stevie Ray Vaughan, you know in one note, that it's Stevie Ray Vaughan. Mm. So time and sound are the two most important things to me. And that's what I felt from Mike on the stage. Like just this force of nature, like pushing the music forward with just the way he played eighth notes.
Mm-hmm.
And so unbelievable.
I suppose so. Playing with Mike was a big turning point in your career. What are other turning points in your career? Other important collaboration like this one?
So it was for sure. It opened a lot more doors and kind of put me on the map in the jazz kind of fusion world. I would say The association with Giorgio Moroder, drummer from Switzerland, huge in the electronic music scene. We've known each other for over 20 years, and working with him, being in his band, recording with him, him being in my band, recording with me, touring all over the world, was pretty huge. Working with Hiram Bullock, very early on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And basically being in like the Jaco Pastorius trio with Kenwood Dennard and Hiram Bullock and me. Like, this is one of my first real big gigs when I got to the US, and I played with Hiram on and off until he passed away in 2008. So that was pretty huge. And of course, even before I got to the States, I'd had this experience of meeting Ayeto Moreira and Flora Purim in London at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club and being invited to play with them, like sit in with the band for 3 weeks. And then Flora Purim was like, you have to move to America. So this is already like in 1997, before I'd even auditioned for Berklee. And she said, you have to move to America. And when you move to America, I'm going to introduce you to Kenwood Dennard. And the first week I got to Boston, I went to Kenwood's office and we played together. And I don't know if you've seen the Jaco Pastorius video. Have you seen this? The instructional video?
No. Mm-hmm.
So is Jerry Jamotte, the classic, the famous studio bass player from Aretha Franklin, is interviewing Jaco Pastorius. And then they cut away and they do a trio segment with John Scofield and Kenwood Dennard. And at the end of the segment, Jaco takes off his bass and he throws it like this over the drums. And Kenwood catches it like this. Okay. So this is like tattooed into my brain, this image. So the first time I play with Kenwood, I take the bass off and I just throw it over the drums. I had to, you know. And so little moments like that in the early stages were pretty huge in terms of integrating into that scene. And the acceptance of American musician. Mm. This country has a lot of flaws. I'm not crazy about living here some of the time, but the community of musicians, no matter what they play, what their background is, has been incredibly inviting. And that was a massive positive kind of force in the, like, just, I would ask something and they would give an answer and they would genuinely want to help you understand the thing you were asking about. And I would suggest something and they were like, I don't know, but let's try. You know, it's a super positive attitude that I think has really, really helped me over the years.
So you think moving from Europe to the US is a must to if you really want to develop as a musician, or is it because of the
not
genre
anymore.
Of music you want to play? You wanted to play?
Not anymore.
Okay.
No, not anymore. I think when I moved, I think I was already 2 decades too late to do what I wanted to do. Like, without trying to sound like an egomaniac, I'm going to say I'm a really good bass player and I play in a style very well. Okay. Just, I'm trying to be objective, not subjective here, but just to highlight the fact of how late I am to the party to play in that style. It's almost a pointless pursuit other than I love it. It's the only justification I can have, because financially or business-wise, it's the dumbest thing you could possibly do to pour all of that time into a genre that has since died. You know, my friend Giorgio Moroder says when he got to New York in the early 90s, he was 40 years too late to be a jazz musician. And he's 100% correct. Mm-hmm. And I got to New York 8 years later in 2000. So I'm almost 5 decades too late, basically, to do any of the things I truly love. And it took at least a decade until about 2010 to finally realize I have to stop looking in the past as much as I love it and look to the future and create my own scene. Mm. So I think it all depends on the personality of the individual. And if you have the focus and the drive and the passion, you can live in Reykjavik or you can live in Toulouse and create a scene. If you have something to offer and you have a way to communicate that, which everyone does with a cell phone these days, it doesn't really matter where you live. Now, if you want experience of playing with Steve Gadd and Dave Weckl and Vinnie Colaiuta and Abel Boreal Jr., yeah, okay, you have to be in Los Angeles. I would not have played with Peter Erskine probably as much as I have had it not been for he lives 20 minutes from me, you know? Mm-hmm. So there are some geographical elements if you want to fulfill some kind of childhood dreams, I would say. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about your music. So you have just released a single called Factor 1000, which is available on Spotify, and there is a video and everything. So tell us about your composition process, because you obviously use a lot of effects and everything. So I am curious to know what was the initial idea maybe behind this piece of music, and how did you intertwine the use of effect and the composition?
Well, things are changing for sure. I mean, when I look through my recorded history, there was a very different process in place until quite recently. So not only am I starting to release singles instead of albums, mm-hmm. because I think people don't have the attention span to listen to 45 or 50 minutes worth of music. It's kind of pointless me putting it out there and only 10% gets listened to. So that's a big change in the process, is make a single. And then, like you said, the effects process, they afford me the opportunity to hear things that I would never have heard with just the acoustic sound, natural sound of the instrument, you know? I got to say, I have quite a good range of finding weird shit on this bass. Like, I can find some weird sounds. It's like probably not an issue. But the next level that it can take with sequencing and synthesis and LFOs and filtering and all of these elements, especially with the single you just talked about, the latest single, Factor 1000, that came from a little sequencer pedal. Just from that rhythmic idea. And then I built this whole soundscape around that one thing. I've since sold the pedal. I literally don't own it anymore. Okay. It served a purpose. I put out that song. I loved it. And I moved on to the next thing. You know, so maybe the process of actually writing and, like, you know, notating things and orchestrating them and having a band and going to the studio will be a thing again. But I definitely think it will be in the form of single.
Mm-hmm. So, and, for a while. And to go back to Factor 1000, so you had this rhythmic idea based on this pedal, and then mm-hmm. you had some kind of theme to play over that, or what we hear and what we see on the video is fully improvised?
Well, there are definitely two themes, like two melodic themes that came from jamming. So kind of an ambient intro, a setting up of the groove, two different melodic statements, and then a solo. And then the melodic statement comes back at the end. So there is form there, but the harmony doesn't change. Once the groove kicks in, it's the same cycle of harmony, because you're that's the one downside, is you're kind of tied to that sequence once you get in there. If you make four bars or eight bars, it's not like a through composed sonata form or something. You're not going to get big forms out of it. So yeah, that's basically the concept behind that.
Mm-hmm. Can you show us again the bass you have, because that's the one we see on the video, correct?
Mm-hmm. That is, yeah. Yep.
So tell us everything about that nice single cut bass.
Where is it? There it is.
I love it. What's that?
Oh. It has an F hole,
okay,
which is actually tuned to an F. It is actually an F note because it's semi hollow here.
Okay, I see. Mm-hmm.
So it's chambered. So it's a little more organic. It's neck through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a kind of unique. It's an oil finish rather than being lacquered.
Okay.
So it's just oiled, which is, it gets really beat up, but it sounds so good and sounds less kind of factory produced. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, five string, high C, so E, A, D, G, C in open fourths, and 28 frets. So I have four octaves in this thing.
And that's really pretty your main instrument? You have to have this kind of range to play the music you want to play?
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. I don't have to have the crazy number of frets. That was really just an experiment. But I do like at least 24. And on my basses before, I've had 26 frets. And this one, we just experimented with 28.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use it that much. Of course, it's not like the range. I'm not like hanging out there playing songs all day.
And let's talk about, so there is an album called The Union, so which was released in 2019, which is,
yeah, exactly.
It seems to be more of a band thing, right? So
yeah, absolutely.
But you composed all the song on that album?
Yeah, yeah, I wrote, that was way more of like a traditional process, mm-hmm. you know? I had a producer for the first time, John Patitucci produced this record,
Not bad.
Is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to have bass ears in the control room,
mm-hmm.
you can't really do better. So that was great. And John, I just, you know, I always love being around him and talking to him and to work on my own music with him. It's like, you know, it's like being a guitar player and having Eddie Van Halen in the room. Like, it's just crazy, you know?
Yeah, but isn't that a little bit scary to have such a huge musician in the control room watching at you while you are recording and sweating bullets and everything?
Well, if it was the first time we had met, maybe, you know? But we know each other now a long time. We share some like similar philosophies about music and practicing and writing and the instrument itself. And, you know, there was John, and the engineer is a very good friend of mine. He's engineered like 80% of my records over my career. He owns the studio. So there's John and John, and then my wife in the control room. It was very relaxed, you know, and some of my best friends in the band. So, and also, in what I love about that like traditional sense of creating the album is that I wrote the music specifically for those musicians. It wasn't for trumpet, piano, and drums. It was for those specific three human beings. So when I start the process way back with that goal, once you get there, it's supernatural, you know, rather than being worried about, oh, you know, can this trumpet player play this trumpet music? Mm. No, I wrote it for Phil. So Phil is going to play the way Phil plays and perfect for what I wrote. Mm. You know, so.
And does this kind of more traditional format jazz is something that, okay, done, got the t-shirt and let's move on, and now you are more into more experimental stuff, or is that part of your personality and you might go back to it? So what's next?
Yes and no. It's a tough question to answer because I love it so much, but it's also quite selfish and mostly pointless. It doesn't do anything for me at the end of the day. Either, you know, the fulfillment of doing it is great during the process.
Yeah.
What happens afterwards is not a tour, is not a recognition of the fact that this ensemble plays great together and that 500 people want to come out every night and see it. This is not 1996 with the Joshua Redman Quartet making an album and going on tour. So there's never that payoff these days. Now, I could see myself making a trio album with Bill Stewart and John Scofield, with Brian Blade and Pat Metheny, with Yo-Yo Ma and Clarence Penn. Like, I have all of these like kind of acoustic, jazz, melodic, harmonic, lush setups in mind. But what do? They break my bank. They never recoup the cost. And it's a vanity project, essentially. As much as perhaps in 300 years when we're all gone and somebody discovers my music and they're like, oh man, that's pretty cool. You know, I can't wait 300 years for that to happen. I'd like to go on the road and play music for real people in real time now. So yes, I am definitely moving into more experimental stuff, more ambient music, more electronic music, more solo stuff. I did a world tour of completely solo, just with the bass and the pedals. I played 80 shows around the world in 2017, which was an experience, you know, traveling through South America with my pedal board and my bass and just playing like on my own for 90 minutes to 2 hours every night. It was a challenge. So I'd like to advance that and maybe add one musician, maybe a duo thing. I don't know.
And I suppose when you play solo, you add, you have a looper and you stack music over.
Two or three loopers. I can sample and create forms and run parallel and series, like all kinds of things. Like, you can create a pretty big sound. There's an album on my Spotify, you know, in my discography. It's a triple album of all the live recordings of that tour from all around the world. So, yeah.
Okay, I need to check this out. I have to ask this question. Does it help to have a hoodie on your head, for your bass tones? Because you always have a hoodie on your videos. So,
like this? Oh, you mean the hat?
Yeah, the hat, sorry. Not the hoodie.
The hat. Yeah, 100%. That's all the secret. That's the time.
Now we know the secret. Okay, excellent.
No, I tell you what, if I didn't have a hat and headphones, my hair would be three times as long as yours and 50 times crazier. Like, just like a crazy gringo afro looking thing. Just horrible. So normally it's about the hair.
Okay.
Not that I don't have any, it's just that I have way too much. And with the pandemic, I didn't have my hair cut for a year. So it was pretty bad.
I was about to ask this question about the impact of the pandemic. So first impact is the problem with the hairdresser. So what, we talked a little bit about that because you did a lot of stuff on the internet, on YouTube, but what are the other impacts on your work as a musician because of the pandemic situation?
Well, I think until this thing came along, I really wasn't the gigging guy anymore. I don't go on tour for 6 months at a time. In 2010, I made a conscious effort to stop touring as a sideman with commercial artists. But up until that point, in 2010, I played 300 shows in 1 year. You know, I slept 11 nights in my own bed in 2010.
Okay.
I mean, it was completely insane. And for what? For kind of nothing, just to promote somebody else's music and not really get paid a lot of money for it. So having made that choice not to do that and to be really selective, like, okay, I'm going to go with Mike Stern. Great. I'm going to go with Randy Brecker. Okay. I'm going to go like with things I want to do. I'm going to do them. So over that time until the pandemic, I didn't think of myself as like the gig guy. I stay home, I choose, I go here a week, come home for a month, go there 5 days. Then the pandemic hit and I realized how much those few gigs, still 50, 60 shows a year, how important they were.
Mm-hmm.
And like even yesterday, like I have my first gig on Friday, it's in 2 days from now, and it's going to be 416 days between gigs.
Okay.
Yeah, this is completely insane. This hasn't happened since I was 15, since I first started playing the bass. And yesterday, I put on some music. I stood up, took the bass. Like, I haven't stood up and played the bass in over a year. And I put on, like, Maroon 5. Bam! And just play over and over and over and over again so I can get some, like, gigging chops back in my fingers. I was very emotional doing that. Mm. Just to stand up and play the bass was in my studio with no one watching or listening was very emotional. So it's been a more, the impact has been more realized the closer I get to going back to doing what all the work is for.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very fortunate in the sense that I wasn't impacted economically as much because I already had an online business since a decade. And the sad thing was seeing a lot of people who didn't have that, who existed only in the gigging economy, trying to launch an online career overnight, and it's just impossible.
Yeah.
You know, the space is too saturated.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sad to see. I tried to help as many people as I could with advice about that and how to get started, and I'm just very happy that we seem to be getting back to, you know, being able to play again.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the situation is beginning to open up a little bit more in Los Angeles, in the LA area where you are at the moment?
Sure. Yeah, in California, yeah. For sure.
Mm-hmm.
Way better than Europe. You know, India is a disaster again. You know, I don't know when I'm going back to Japan, for instance. Like, I'm in Japan normally at least once, if not twice a year. And right now, we can't even book a show there. So that's probably going to be early 2022. But in Los Angeles, yeah, we're coming back. Like I said, first gig Friday. I think they've been open for 10 days, the club. But only 20 people inside in a club that holds 120. So very reduced capacity. With the mask on stage, you have to have a proof of a test, negative test, or proof of vaccine just to come in the building. I mean, it's very strict.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's strict, I think is the reason that things are coming back online. And by probably July, we should be fully open here.
And with 20 people in the audience, is that viable economically, or is that a stream gig, or what's the idea?
I don't know.
Who is paying?
It doesn't affect me. It really doesn't, because I do the gig, I get paid $5, $0, $500. It doesn't matter. I don't play a local gig in town at a small club to make a living. I'm very fortunate in that sense. So I don't actually know. I can't answer your question.
Okay.
I know that the club has struggled. And they've been accepting donations, and they've been trying to do live streams, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, it's going to be very tough, and they are just about hanging on. You know, they can do limited opening for maybe 2 months, and then they have to open again, or they close forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what are the next projects you have in store for the rest of the year? Tell us.
For the rest of this year, nothing.
Okay.
Like this, because we
and
can't plan. No, for sure. 2022. This year is planning, basically. It's to stay home and record and write and produce and then plan for 2022. Probably the biggest thing, well, the most well-known thing will be a special project with Randy Brecker, Dennis Chambers, myself, George Witty, probably Alex Acuna. They're kind of an all-star band to tour in Japan and make a record. But so many other little things happening. You know, I want to make a project of duets, for instance. So making kind of like the Factor 1000 thing you heard, but a little more ambient, a little less like smacking you in the face. And then bringing people like, you know, Brad Meldow or Herbie Hancock or like serious musicians to collaborate with. I have a lot. I have more, like the Mike Stone goal from 20 years ago. I have 50 more of those still,
okay.
of incredible musicians that I want to play with, you know.
If people want to get in touch with you, check out all the books you have and everything, where should you go? What's your website?
YannickGuizdala.com. I was going to say it's that simple, but my name is not simple to spell. I'm not difficult to find, though. You type bass, and even if you put the French spelling of Yannick in there, like Yannick Noah, you're going to find me still. You know what I mean?
Okay, Yannick, it was great to be able to have you on the show. So hopefully we will be able to meet face to face, either at, I don't know, Le Baiser Salé, or you might come to my showroom in Paris and we'll do another interview face to face. Okay?
For sure. Thank you very much, man.
All right. Thank you very much for your time, Yannick. Bye-bye.
Bye. Yeah.
For the price of a magazine, subscribe to The Guitar Channel to access the full videos.